So I think in that prepartum and early lactation period is really the time in which you can be fancy and play with the different fatty acids. You know, the new data on oleic acid, optimizing insulin signaling and minimizing lipomobilization, it's something to think about. But also the anti-inflammatory fatty acids, particularly the most powerful of those, which are the really long chain, you know, 4 to 6 double bonds, the EPA and DHA fatty acids that could be fed in that period without being concerned about a loss in milk fat synthesis.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Did you know that beta-carotene deficiency can affect fertility rates and reproductive performance? Victus Transition from DSM Firmenich provides beta-carotene to help your cattle fertility rates. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of Smartamine M and MilkPay.com. Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd.
Hello, welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University, and today I'm very happy to welcome back to the show one of our favorite guests, Dr. Jose Santos from the University of Florida. How's it going today, Jose?
Good morning, Barry. I'm doing really, really well. So thank you for having me here.
Yeah, we've talked about a little bit of your background in the past, and you've led a very interesting life. But one thing I thought it'd be fun to dig into a little bit today is the time you spent on sabbatical. So maybe first of all, for those that were not as lucky as us to spend time in academia, what is a sabbatical?
Well, it's actually an interesting question because I told this to my brother once. Sabbatical is really a time that you are entitled, at least we are at this point still, to take some time off and either stay where you are or go somewhere else to do something different that will add to your knowledge or your portfolio or establish collaboration. In academia, typically a sabbatical, you would be eligible after a period of time. Obviously, I think in every institution you have to be tenure to be entitled to go on sabbatical. And most people will go somewhere where they can learn something new or a place where they already have some collaboration. So you might spend anywhere between 6 months to a year, either to complete a research project and learn new techniques or basically just work on things that you got way behind and you need to catch up with. Yeah. So those things, it's really a time for contemplation and, to get you out of the day-to-day mold, just doing the same thing over and over and over. And I have to say it's a blast. Probably one of, if not the best thing I've done in academia was my sabbatical, which I eventually went to Australia. I loved it.
I think it's kind of a brilliant way. Like you hear a lot of professionals today talk about burnout, and I think it's a real thing and probably having your computer and phone with you all the time is contributing to that. But it's, I think, a great way to sort of recharge, right, and get excited about your work again. And
Yeah. I'm sure in every profession, there is a point in time that you say, am I going to be doing the same thing over and over for the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years, whatever period of time. So sabbatical is a break in between. Yeah?
Elevate animal performance with Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition, your trusted ally in excellence. Their high-quality feed ingredients like coated nutrients and fat powders provide ruminants with extra energy, boosting health, productivity, and cost efficiency. Unleash your herd's potential with Berg & Schmidt.
Yeah, so I want to hear a little more about your time in Australia. When did you go there and what was your focus? Where did you go?
So I went to the University of Sydney, in the east coast of Australia. I went there in 2017, spent 11 months with a wonderful host, Ian Lean. Ian has sort of a different appointment. He's an adjunct faculty. He was a faculty member in the Veterinary College at the University of Sydney. But it's been, I don't know how long, he's built his own business, consulting research business. So he does contract research, but still tied up to the veterinary school in Sydney. But he's about an hour from Sydney, where the university has a teaching and research campus where probably most of the food animal program is, which is a little a town called Camden, which is just a beautiful site, 60 kilometers from the city, as they say in Australia. City is the big place and everywhere else is something other than the city. So I spend really my time in Ian's office working with him and his colleagues, and also had some interaction with the folks in the veterinary school. So I was there from January to December of 2017.
I've been lucky enough to visit that campus, and probably a lot of our audience has heard about that at some point, because that's probably maybe one of the biggest places in the world where they're doing work on using robots to help manage grazing cows, and like almost like a herd dog. They've got robots in training there.
That's right. Yeah. There's this push in Australia for this automated systems where, you know, you have milking systems without a milker, or you have this easy flow of cows coming from pasture to the parlor. Not an easy task, I have to say. One of the highlights, I have to say, of my sabbatical was that, you know, my limited understanding of the academic system in Australia was that a lot of it was built by foreigners who came primarily from England when they were building universities last century. So Ian, in the very first Monday of the month, organized a lunch with the retired faculty. So I met with folks that did breakthrough research, and we had wonderful lunch. It was a wine lunch.
Yeah.
So every Monday we would select, or every month, I should say, not every Monday, but every first Monday of the month, we would select a region of Australia or a wine type or something, and just sit down for 2 or 2.5 hours and chat. And it was, I really enjoyed that. So.
If I'm not mistaken, one of your projects that you tackled that year in collaboration with Ian and others is to try to do sort of a comprehensive analysis of the literature on feeding fat to dairy cows and impacts on reproduction and health. Is that correct?
When I went on sabbatical, one of the goals was to finish up some of the collaborative work we had started here in Florida. I received one of Ian's PhD students. She spent time here, Rachel Rodney. And also for me to go there and learn new techniques in data analysis. So Ian is well known for his skills in meta-analysis. So we work on a couple of different projects. One was on fat feeding, which was really led by Rachel. She was the lead person on that. She was doing that work. And then another one, which was with DCAD in prepartum diets.
Okay. Well, that kind of leads in nicely, I think, to the topic today. And maybe you'll draw on some of that meta-analysis work. But thought we could talk about your thoughts on how we can use dietary fats maybe to promote success in early lactation in a variety of ways. And, you know, there's new data coming out every year on milk production responses, and maybe we can get into that too. But I thought we could kind of focus on health and reproductive outcomes. So I guess maybe from a 20,000 foot view, first of all, how do you think about putting dietary fat in if you're feeding fresh cows?
Isn't that amazing? Like when I started graduate school, feeding fat to early lactation cow was a dogma. Eh? There's maybe one or two papers out there and the results were not great. And that was sort of a crime to do that, to consider adding fatty acids to early lactation diets other than the basal fatty acids in the ingredients. But over the years, we've learned that when used in moderation, I think that's the key here, is how much you feed and probably the type of fatty acid as well. But how much you feed is a big point. In the past, people in general, they did proof of concept experiments, and some of those they were feeding 4, 5, 6 percentage points additional fatty acids in the diet. So obviously that's going to suppress appetite, maybe interfere with rumen function, and possibly the results are not going to be very attractive above and beyond the economic aspect. But I think we learned a lot. So there's been a lot of data, on meal composition, and a lot of data on production responses, particularly from the work done by Adam Locke at Michigan State University with palmitic acid. And I think it became probably just a staple ingredient in fresh cow diets, supplement 1%, maybe 1.5% of the dry matter supplemental fatty acids, primarily because of the drive of milk yield, in particular energy-corrected milk. Yeah, so the big boost in fat yield when those diets are formulated. Obviously, with that, there may be potential benefits to reproduction. And one of the findings of the meta-analysis conducted by Ian's group at the time showed that from pulling together the data from randomized experiments was that there is a benefit to pregnancy prey at first insemination, and there is a tendency for reduction in days open with supplemental fats, irrespective of the source that was added to the diet. So, yeah, so there's these two sides of improving production performance, but also having a benefit to reproduction in cows.
Let's take a second and dig into that finding that sort of the source of fat didn't seem to matter in that meta-analysis. And I probably am biased towards like sort of very specific biochemical processes as opposed to just thinking about energy, right? But acknowledge that it could just be energy. How do you think about that?
Yeah, so I totally agree with you. So probably a misconception in the field is that, and it's very common to hear from consultants and nutritionists, hey, my fresh cows are not adequate body condition, maybe they are on the thin side, I'm going to add more fat to recover body condition faster. And if you look at all the literature, there's really no indication that feeding fat in the first months of lactation improves energy balance or recovery of body condition. It's very different, the response when you feed fat in early lactation versus mid to late lactation. So I really am from the school that does not believe that you are adding fat just because of the caloric content, and that is going to improve energy balance and have benefits to reproduction. I'm more of the school that they are signaling molecules, the fatty acids are signaling molecules, and probably some have more benefit than others. But that is tricky, because how do you get individual fatty acids past the rumen? And how do you do that, particularly the unsaturated, without affecting milk fat synthesis? That's always been the challenge. Yeah? And unfortunately, the products in the market, they do not protect fatty acids. That's a big misconception, is that the fat products that we feed to cows today, they are quote-unquote protected fats. They are really somewhat rumen inert fat sources, but not necessarily protected fatty acids. And I think that's where we have difficulty in sorting out the individual effects or the effects of the individual fatty acids.
So, yeah, I think that's a good point. And I probably even stated it wrong. You didn't find differences by source, but that doesn't mean they don't exist, right?
That is exactly right. Yes. And a lot of it is just the weakness of the data. You don't have enough power to detect differences. Yeah. So the challenge we always have working with data such as Repro and Health is to design experiments that are large enough to pick up effects just because of the nature of binomial data. And unfortunately, the intervention is applied to the diet. So you have to feed cows individually, or you have to have many, many groups of cows. And that's always difficult to execute because of all the challenges of doing these types of experiments. Yeah.
And, you know, I think of you as a trailblazer in terms of finding ways and, well, finding hard enough working students. And I know you're super hardworking to actually take on those studies where you're individually, you know, dosing nutrients to hundreds and hundreds of animals. And, you know, kudos for that. But are you aware, you know, we're learning more and more about bioactive effects of specific fatty acids. if we think about specific disease issues in fresh cow, let's say metabolic problems, ketosis, fatty liver, what is the evidence there in terms of fatty acids having a benefit for metabolic health?
I would say it's quite limited at this point. So mechanistically, yes, we could make cases. For example, early lactation cows are prone to developing disease. Just the process of parturition induces an inflammatory response. Yeah. So obviously, you could make a case that anti-inflammatory fatty acids, such as those that belong to the omega-3 family, would play an important role at that time. We've explored that, feeding omega-3 fatty acids pre-partum with the expectation that we would enrich lipid pools in the body. And perhaps when cows calve and they mobilize lipids, maybe some of the triacylglycerols they mobilize from body depots, fat depots, they would release a different profile of fatty acids that would be beneficial at dumping the pro-inflammatory response. Yes, there are some indications, but can we go out there and state that we're going to have, let's say, fewer cases of ketosis or less triacylglycerol accumulation in the liver? I think we are still early in that process. At least I'm not aware of the experiments that clearly demonstrate that, and it's it can be replicated. So in theory, yes, I would say an easy one would be, what if I feed more alpha-linolenic acid or eicosapentaenoic or docosahexaenoic? They all have strong anti-inflammatory properties. So it would probably be beneficial to cows in the first 2 or 4 weeks of lactation. But the evidence still hasn't appeared very clearly. Small experiments, some indication, blood markers, but a smaller incidence of disease, I think we still need to complete those experiments.
So when you think about dietary fat as a means to sort of potentially improve metabolic health in fresh cows, you're mostly thinking about anti-inflammatory properties, or are there other pathways as well?
There's probably other effects. So there's early work that Rick Grammer did when he was doing in vitro liver slices, and he was loading those cells with different fatty acids. He and his graduate students clearly showed that the polyunsaturated fatty acids seem to be taken up more efficiently by hepatocytes. And in the case of the polyunsaturates, they tend to be more oxidized as opposed to be re-esterified in the liver. So I guess you could make the case that those data would suggest that you might attenuate triacylglycerol incorporation into the liver. So there's some suggestion from in vitro work that particularly the omega-3, if I recall the data correctly, they tend to favor oxidation as opposed to re-esterification. So in that case, perhaps you would see greater concentration of ketones in blood, but less fatty liver, which would be a benefit to the cow. However, I always, and maybe those effects are there, and maybe you do have anti-inflammatory properties in the liver that would attenuate lipogenesis or re-esterification of lipids in the hepatocyte. And that is obviously good for liver cell function. But I always think of, in this process, the liver has an energy requirement, So it has a certain amount of ATP that the cell needs, and it probably is not going to go above and beyond just for the sake of oxidizing lipids. So once that ATP needs is met, it has to divert the pathway to something else. So that's probably why ketogenesis kicks in, or that's probably why you get re-esterification. So if we don't stop excessive lipid mobilization in our lactation, I think it will be unlikely we're going to be very successful with any dietary intervention of attenuating fatty liver, for example. Yeah, maybe we can enhance export. That might be a point, and that would be good. But I'm not sure if fatty acids do that. They stimulate lipoprotein secretion. It's not something that I'm aware of.
Our Yeast 40 is a natural biotechnology from ICC, designed to boost the health and productivity of animals under challenging production systems. Our Yeast 40 performance is supported by an unique processing technology that results in a pure product containing high levels of beta-glucans, MOS, and yeast metabolites. These factors combined promote the ruminal and intestinal modulation, helping the animals to reach their full potential.
And then on the reproductive side, I know you've collaborated on a lot of nice work, really kind of defining maybe two or three or four levels at which or biological processes that fatty acids could influence that might explain, you know, what I think of as, you know, repeated meta analyses over decades have pointed to at least some benefit of feeding fatty acids on reproduction. Where do you stand now in terms of what do you think are the most likely mechanisms? And does that vary in your, you know, if you had to guess, does that vary by fatty acid source?
Yeah, so obviously any fatty acid can be a precursor for steroid synthesis. So as long as you increase the pool of acetyl-CoA in cells or in the body, you deliver lipids to the corpus luteum, you're going to enhance progesterone secretion. So progesterone obviously is a key molecule for stimulating embryo development and obviously maintenance of pregnancy. There's been quite a bit of research by Dr. Bill Thatcher looking at how fatty acids can dump in prostaglandin release. And that was a hypothesis that was put forth for many, many years that we can attenuate prostaglandin release and perhaps help maintain pregnancy in lesser developed embryos that don't have a strong crosstalk between the maternal side and the embryonic side or the fetal side at that stage. So I think the effects of fatty acids are multiple and they go well beyond those simple mechanism. Obviously, yes, you do increase progesterone concentration in blood. That's a hallmark. You feed fat to beef cows, you feed fat to dairy cows, and you measure progesterone. You always get maybe 1 or 2 nanograms more per ml during mid-luteal phase of progesterone. So that's one thing. So that probably has an impact because progesterone induces secretory activity in the endometrial glands, and that helps nourish the embryo in that early stages of pregnancy. But fatty acids also alter the cell population in the endometrium. So particularly the omega-3 fatty acids, they tend to stimulate the TGF-beta system. They tend to stimulate accumulation of more what we call tolerogenic immune cells that may suppress this surveillance mechanism by the dam against potential what we call alloantigens of paternal side of pregnancy. So the ability of the dam to recognize non-self antigens from the fetus might be altered in that case. And there's some evidence from literature other than in ruminants that shows that. But in ruminants, gestation is extended by a day or so, particularly in sheep when they are fed omega-3 fatty acids. So those examples in literature are there. They are not as common in dairy cattle data. But there are major changes in signaling molecules in the endometrium and in the embryo through RNA sequencing and microarray work that was done in the past. So there's multiple effects. So it's probably a combination of that, stimulating progesterone secretion, maybe altering the pattern of prostaglandin release, altering the immune cell population that populates the uterus and the placenta during pregnancy, and altering how the embryo and the maternal side communicate. So that probably plays a role in this benefit. And different fatty acids probably have different effects on that. The challenge is to know what fatty acid gets to the intestine and gets transferred to the tissues. Yeah.
That's what makes this kind of a frustrating area to work in, right? It's hard to know what's actually getting absorbed, and then how can you explain mechanisms if you don't even know that? But, well, one thing I appreciate about you, Jose, is that you do an awesome job, I think, of clarifying the degree of certainty with which you can answer a question, which I think is a hallmark of a great scientist and a great advisor. But of course, you and I talk all the time with consultants who don't have the luxury of waiting another 10 years to put a diet together. Okay, so I'm just curious, put yourself in the shoes of a consulting nutritionist. You've got to put a dietary strategy together today for a farm that you want to help improve reproductive success. How would you approach that in the first 3 months of lactation?
Yeah, so I am under the assumption that the farm is capable of feeding a prepartum diet, a fresh cow diet, and a high cow diet. So let's go from that assumption. I would not be very concerned about milk fat in the fresh pen, just because you get high milk fat anyways. And it's such a short period of time that it's unlikely to affect the bulk tank milk fat to the point that you're going to take a loss in terms of payment, yeah? So I think in that prepartum and early lactation period is really the time in which you can be fancy and play with the different fatty acids. So, you know, the new data on oleic acid minimizing perhaps or optimizing insulin signaling and minimizing lipomobilization is something to think about. But also the anti-inflammatory fatty acids, particularly the most powerful of those, which are the really long chain, you know, 4 to 6 double bonds, the EPA and DHA fatty acids that could be fed in that period without being concerned about a loss in milk fat synthesis. So in the real world, if price allows, because that's obviously it's a big concern, I think there is an opportunity to feed a moderate amount of fat in the late gestation period, maybe 100 grams of supplemental fatty acids to a prepartum cow. And then in the early lactation period, perhaps 200 grams, 250 grams. And in that 200, 250 grams, so half of, a little less than half a pound, incorporate some of those omega-3 fatty acids, not just the palmitic acids typically fed. The challenge is once you leave that fresh pen, and in today's market, I don't think there is room for something other than it would be very difficult to go away from C16 at that stage, or a combination of C16 with some oleic acid, some other fatty acid there, just because of our pricing system, and producers have gotten used, which is wonderful, to high production with very high components. Yeah, so you get below 4% fat, they get mad, then your job is in the line, yeah? So that's an issue. You have to live with that.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Our Yeast 40 Ruminal and Intestinal Double Modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergen Schmidt Animal Nutrition. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Maximize profitability and herd health with early detection in animal health, reproduction, and feeding. The most advanced bolus technology and professional support from agricultural experts make this possible with SmaxTech, the health management system that future-proofs your dairy operation.
Well, you've already answered the three famous questions in the past, so this conversation has brought to mind for me sort of the fairly dramatic shifts we've seen in human dairy product consumption in the last 5 years, especially in the U.S. You know, there's sort of been a reversal of fat being evil, you know, in a diet, a huge reemphasis on dietary protein, and that's had a big impact on what's actually getting leaving the shelves, you know, in grocery stores and such. I'm curious, if you look in your crystal ball, you know, how do you see that evolving in the next few years? And do you think that's going to have a meaningful impact on how we make decisions on feeding the cows themselves?
I think people consume products because they taste good and they like, yeah? So I consume products because I like. Anything in moderation is probably not bad for you. You may say it may not be good for you necessarily, but it's probably not bad. for you. So yesterday, my friend here, John Bromfield, sent us a paper on the positive impacts of drinking beer on the gut microbiome. And Pete Hansen, another colleague, immediately jumped in and said, I knew this since I was 15 years of age when I started drinking beer. So anyways, I think
confirmation bias,
you know, jokes aside, but yeah, I think protein will still be a major drive. People like cheese. Cheese is the biggest drive probably today of dairy consumption. You know, the dogma of fat that came particularly from the U.S. influence in the 30s and 40s from, I think if you go back, you'll see that Ansel Keys was really the person who changed that and create this paradigm that consuming animal fat is bad for you, which is not true. Yeah. So we learned that the hard way. So I think we'll maintain that. So dairy is really well positioned, but there will be probably exploration of bioactive compounds. There's things that we know today, but for whatever reason is left to the side and is not mentioned, such as the conjugated linoleic acid, you know, very powerful anti-carcinogenic, anti-diabetogenic product, or some of those are. I think there will be some opportunity in the future for that. But at the end of the day, in my very simplistic view, I drink milk because I like, I eat cheese because it tastes good, and I eat hamburger because it tastes wonderful. And I think we're not going to change that. We're omnivores at the end of the day. Yeah?
No, I agree with you. But some of these things, I think in the overall dairy market, it's probably a minimal impact. But like I didn't necessarily anticipate like the colostrum craze, right?
Oh, some of these. Yeah.
It's interesting.
Think about that. You know, people are selling colostrum for human consumption today. And it's very expensive.
Well, Jose, of course, I always love talking with you. Thank you for taking the time today to have another episode here.
Well, thank you for having me, Barry. It's a pleasure, always.
So again, this has been Dr. Jose Santos from the University of Florida, and I'm Barry Bradford from Michigan State University. This has been another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show brought to you by Wisenetics. And if you haven't followed the show yet, make sure you click the button so you see the next episode, and we'll see you then.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.